to The Divine Breadcrumb with your hosts, Carol Campos and Deb Sorensen. Carol and Deb have always believed the universe helps people on their path by sending signs, clues, or what they call divine breadcrumbs. A divine breadcrumb can create both small and massive shifts in a person's life. On this podcast, Carol and Deb will speak with authors, healers, entrepreneurs, and other amazing people across the globe to discuss these pivotal moments. So get ready to learn, to love, and to laugh. And remember, the universe always provides if you allow it to. Enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. This is Deb, co-host of The Divine Breadcrumb. I just wanted to share a few quick comments about this episode. First, we discuss some emotionally charged subjects that may be triggering for some. Carol and I wanted to mention that up front so as not to cause any distress for any of our listeners. Second, due to the time constraints of the show, we do move through these subjects quickly. By no means are we implying that any of this is trivial. This easily could have been several episodes, but we wanted to highlight Lisa's inspiring story and her amazing resilience. We think you'll be moved by this. Carol and I certainly have been.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Divine Breadcrumb. I'm Carol.
This is Deb. Yes, welcome back.
Today, we are talking with Dr. Lisa Geer, author of the brilliant, heartbreaking, yet inspiring new book, Flashback Girl, Lessons on Resilience from a Burn Survivor. When Lise was only 4 years old, she was burned over 65% of her body and spent most of her childhood in the hospital undergoing countless surgeries and enduring more trauma than any human being should ever have to endure. And you have to remember that in 1967, burn victims were not put in medically induced comas to shield them from the pain. In fact, the children weren't given anything for the pain. But after she left the hospital, her life didn't get easier. She dealt with disfigurement, bullying, parental neglect, and family suicides. Now, this would be enough to break anyone, but incredibly, Lise did not only persevere, but has become successful in every sense of the word. Lise attended Tufts University and later earned her doctorate in clinical psychology from Widener University. Now has a thriving private practice and a wonderful husband and two amazing daughters. But before all this, she went through virtual hell. And today we're going to talk to her about the details of that fateful day in 1967, the toxic relationship she had with her mother, the suicide of her favorite person in the world, and of course, the many lessons learned in resilience. Deb and I were deeply affected by Lisa's book and are anxious to dive in. Lise, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my honor to be with you today.
Yeah, we're really, really looking forward to talking with you. The book was incredible, and I urge everyone listening to go check it out.
Absolutely. So Lise, if you would, take us back to that day in the summer of 1967 when you were 4 years old, and then maybe share what transpired in those first few months at the hospital.
Sure. When I was 4 years old, my family went on a brief vacation. And the first night of the vacation, we stayed at this cabin, and it was on a lake. And we were on the porch of the cabin, and the porch had a fence around it. That detail is incredibly important, actually. So it was, you know, dinner time, and my mother was going to start a barbecue for dinner. And she searched around this cabin and got a can of something she thought was lighter fluid. And so she poured the lighter fluid on the coals and tried to light them, and they didn't light. And all during this time, I'm standing right next to her. So my mother took that same can of something that, again, she thought was lighter fluid, but it turns out to be a highly flammable household solvent. And she poured it onto the coals again. And at that moment, this can of solvent exploded into a fiery bomb all over my mother and me, and blocking off all access off that porch. My mother God bless my mother, she was who she was. And she realized instantly that there was one way off that porch, and that was to dash through the flame itself and into the lake nearby. And that's what she did. But she left me in the fire. So I was left trapped alone and abandoned on fire. And my father figured out a way to reach me from behind, and he rescued me. And off to the hospital we went. At the end of that, 2 minutes of horror, I was left third degree burned on 65% of my body. My lower lip was burned away, my chin, my neck, and my face was essentially fused to my chest. And my upper arms were fused to my torso through, lack of skin. And I was in the hospital for that time for 5 months, but many, 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 many times to come. And I can tell you more about that, but maybe I'll just rest here and stop for a second.
Yeah, that whole opening part of the book, when you talk about that first hospitalization, is gut-wrenching, not in any sort of a sensationalized way, but just, to hear about that experience and what that treatment is like in 1967. And then knowing when I burned myself the other day, pulling a pan out of the stove to the tip of my finger, and you would have thought that I had a, terminal injury. It hurt so bad. I can't even imagine.
Well, I think you also mentioned in the book, Lise, it's like, it was so unlucky, but lucky that you were very close to Mass General at the time.
Yeah, that is, I think, a very interesting aspect of my story, and maybe about life in general, because I was so incredibly unfortunate to be burned in this massive fire. I, have faced a lifetime of, scarring and disfigurement and discomfort, and the recovery from the burns was horrific. And yet, at the same time, because we were on vacation, we happened to be brought, transferred. We weren't initially brought, but transferred immediately to Mass General Hospital in Boston, which at the time was the premier hospital for burns in the country, if not the world. And I was assigned this brilliant young plastic surgeon named Dr. Constable, who was, again, one of the best surgeons for burns in the world. And the Shriners Burns Institute was just forming at that time, and I became one of their first charity cases. And so they gave me all of my surgeries, all of which, again, they were horrific, but just the same, they saved me. All of my burn care, all of my surgeries, all of these things that I went through, they provided to me for free. So it's interesting how you can be, again, horribly unfortunate, and yet there were these gifts there for me too, which saved my life.
Yeah, it really is amazing. Because, if you had been in, Ohio, or Iowa on vacation, who knows? It would have been a different, very different story.
Yeah, it was very tough to survive an injury like mine at the time. Although there are others, you can find us old veterans out there. But it wasn't, it was not common. And I think the thing that you alluded to before, I'll just say this because people really don't know it. At the time in the late 60s, they did not provide pain relief for children, for burned children. I don't know why, but they didn't. They just didn't. And so burns are basically pretty much the most painful thing that the human body can endure. And so us little burn kids were essentially medically tortured for our own good. That's how they saved us. But at the same time, it was an excruciating thing. It's very interesting now, when I meet with burn survivors like me who've been around for a while, and we just, when you get us talking, there's just a lot of smiles of like, oh yeah. You guys have no idea what this was like. And thank God now that, you know, the science has advanced a lot. But it is still not easy being burned, even for someone who's burned, you know, these days. It is still a very difficult and painful and tragic thing to go through.
Yeah. And I think what struck, I mean, there's so many things that struck me. I mean, obviously, you know, the changing of the bandages and that physical pain. But then there was also the element that your mother was in the same hospital for some time with you, but wasn't coming to visit you. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So my mother, again, was burned just like I was, although, you know, not nearly as badly. And we were hospitalized, both of us at Mass General at the time. And it would have been very easy for her to come see me. And she certainly should have, because I was close to death a couple times. But she did not come for some weeks. And my father would try to exhort her, you know, to visit me. And she would just say, that she couldn't. And that was very much a harbinger of things to come with my mother and the person that she was. She could be really, you know, a very interesting person. She was gifted and charming and had a lot to offer in terms of culture. But she was very much focused on herself and her own needs. And if what you needed from her was in contrast to what she wanted to do, she would choose what she wanted to do, regardless of how that was going to affect people, including me and my own brother. Like, she just always picked herself.
Yeah. And I just can't imagine being 4 years old. And, you know, you touch on the book, you know, later in life, you had your own daughters. And when they were the same age, you look at them, and you think, how in the world could a mother not have come to visit them? And so all those emotions come up. And you can't help but make some comparisons to how you would have handled the situation.
Right. And I am sure that's an experience that, you know, many listeners have, of the experience of once you have children, as they're growing up, you can't even help but compare what you're trying to give them or what they're experiencing with what you were provided, you know, for better or for worse. I know as a psychologist, I have a lot of clients that's when they start therapy is, you know, say their child reaches the age, I don't know, 7 years old, and seven is the age that they themselves were traumatized. And all of a sudden, all their traumatic memories start coming back in a different sort of way. I just think that's a pretty common experience for us as parents.
Yeah, absolutely. There's one story that really I loved, and I'm not sure exactly how old you were at this point. You were still in the hospital and a little girl, and it just showed your resilience and just how you still had that just kind of childlike curiosity despite everything that had happened. And it was when you talk about just getting out of bed and kind of, you know, padding out with your little hospital slippers and exploring. And nobody said a word. Like, I can't even imagine that, you know, there's this little girl, clearly a burn victim, you know, walking around by herself in Mass General, and then you'd walk right back to bed and nobody would even say anything.
I know. You know, you have to laugh. I mean, those of us who are of a certain age, you know, the 60s and the 70s were a different kind of time.
Yes,
it was. Yeah, exactly. Very true.
Yeah. And, you know, I think lots of people will say, oh, my, you know, I was out of the house until it was dinner time and nobody knew where I was.
So true.
Yes.
And so this is my own version of those kinds of stories. I was out of the house, meaning my in the hospital, exploring the world, meaning the hospital, and nobody knew where I was until dinner time. It's kind of the same thing, but in a hospital.
Yeah, I love that. It did kind of make me chuckle because that is what it made me think of. It's like, no, I'm just taking my walk. And for the listeners, Lise knew kind of how to get places because, you know, when her dad would come to visit, he would take her for walks. So she got to know the lay of the land. But I just thought that was so cute and just so typically a kid. Mm-hmm. Just exploring. Before we move on to the next question, there was one more thing I wanted to bring up. While you were little in the hospital, you know, you'd mentioned Dr. Constable and how he was kind of your savior, your guardian angel during this time. And because you had burns over so much of your body, I love how you explained that he would always hold your foot or your toe, kind of give you comfort, and even before a surgery.
Yes. So Dr. Constable is, sadly, he's died now, but he was a very special man. And, you know, even just talking about him, I can just feel the emotion in my chest as I talk about him. He was, you know, this brilliant plastic surgeon. He was born in Britain. He had this really patrician accent, Harvard, all that. And so you might think he would be, I don't know, not particularly emotionally accessible. And in some ways he wasn't, but in a deeper way he was. And I always felt like he really understood that I was this little kid all alone going through something awful. And he found his way always to make me feel loved and safe and cared for. And one of the things he did every time, except for one time that was not under his control, every time as I was going off to sleep for my operations, he would hold my foot and he would just look me in the eyes and hold my foot kind of tightly, sort of to say, like, I'm here, we're here together, we'll all be okay. And it was. He took excellent care of me.
That's wonderful.
Amazing man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the title of the book is Flashback Girl. Share with our audience how that term came into your awareness decades after the fire. And what new information did you learn about your mother's role in the fire when you discovered the term Flashback Girl?
Yeah. So this incident that you're describing, Deb, happened like 3 weeks before my mother died, maybe a month before she died. Oh, yes, I know exactly when it was, because it was the 50th anniversary of the fire. So August 17th. And I sat down and I just kind of started to do a weird Google search about my fire. And I found that the lawyer whom my parents had hired to represent me after this accident had actually presented in front of the United States Senate about product safety. And my accident was one of the accidents that he discussed. And in fact, my picture of like me, like right after the fire, terribly burned, was presented to the United States Senate. And I'm looking at this, you know, report in the United States Senate records going, oh, my God, I had no idea. So I tried to call my lawyer, but he had, you know, he had passed away. And I spoke to his younger brother. I said, hello, I'm Lise DeGeer. You know, your brother represented me years ago for this fire. And there was this, he went, oh, are you the Flashback Girl? And I'm like, what? And he said, oh, no, your case was kind of famous. We presented on your case all the time. So Flashback, so that's a reference to the kind of fire it was. Remember I said it was a can that exploded? Mm-hmm. And so what that is that the flame flashed back into the can of flammable material and exploded. So that's the name Flashback Girl. And I thought, wow, first of all, cool name in terms of describing the fire. Second of all, cool name in terms of describing the emotional experience of flashbacks, which most people know about. Mm-hmm. And cool name in kind of superhero-esque connotations. So that became the title, Flashback Girl.
I love that. It's just such a perfect title.
Yeah. Well, you can thank my deceased lawyer.
And that was when you also found out that it wasn't lighter fluid, right? At that same point?
Yes. Yeah, so my family had always told me that it was lighter fluid that my mother poured on these charcoals. And I mean, you know, anybody who knows me knows that I told that story for 50 years. The lighter fluid exploded. And then I found out that it wasn't lighter fluid. It was this household solvent. I'm like, why did they make it sound like it was lighter fluid? I don't know. And this was just a few weeks before my mother died. And I thought very much about asking her about it. And then I thought, nope, I'm not going to go there.
Right.
Yeah. And was it also around this time you kind of had a thought about the fact that, you know, most of her burns were on her back because she had turned her back to you?
Yes. Although I will say, I think I had already noticed that.
Yeah.
Right.
But more that, yes, exactly. You've noticed it, but maybe kind of dug into that deeper emotionally. It's like, because that was the metaphor for she turned her back on your child.
Yes. I think I'm going to imagine there are plenty of listeners out there who have had wonderful mothers, loving, present, caring mothers, and that there's also not a small percentage of listeners out there who've had disappointing mothers, mothers who have not really come through for them, mothers who have been not present. And that was my experience. And it's been really interesting to me in writing this book, which is partly about my mother and who she thought she was versus who she really actually was. It's been it's a big part of the book, and it is seems to be a part of the book that resonates with unfortunately a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will get to some of those lessons with her in a moment. Let's go back to like you still being a child. You know, you've explained that the fire left you severely disfigured, and you mentioned in the book that you had to walk to school by yourself and you were very little because your parents didn't want to give you, you know, quote unquote, special treatment. What were those early years of school like for you?
Yeah. So there was a tremendous amount of bullying back at that time. And, you know, this is a time was very different from this time. We didn't even talk about bullying as something that was like bad or that we should stop, or it was just not a topic of conversation. It was just something that some kids were bullied and some kids weren't. And I was one of the ones that really was, you know, every day I would have like kids running past me going, ugh! You know,
oh my God.
Like, I was hideous. I will say I truly was, but you know, people were incredibly unkind. Now, that being like, I found just the saddest thing the other day. I found something that my father had put in a file, and I'd read it before, but I'd forgotten about it. This little thing that I wrote when I was in third grade, and you know, it talks about how like all the kids make fun of me, that sort of thing. Having said that, the kids who did know me, the kids who knew me in my class were wonderful. So I have always had the ability to make friends, and I had good friends. I was never just alone with those mean bullying people, but they were in my life every day. Sort of that element was always there. And there was no parental protection and there was no school protection. It was just sort of like, yeah, okay, well, that's what you got.
Yeah. I can relate, and but you know, obviously not to that degree. But yeah, it is amazing to me how cruel kids can be, and that it took so long for that to be raised as an issue.
Yeah, yes. I agree. Well, and even growing up, you know, we're all around the same age. The way parents handled things, it was very much like, suck it up, this will build character type of thing.
Yes. Yep. Walk it off. Yep.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Sticks and stones.
Oh right. My God, Deb. Right. I forgot about that. I mean, I remember thinking like, well, okay, I guess I feel like they hurt me.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. You did share a story in the book where an older gentleman brought you into his rose garden. Can you share that story?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, so every day I walked back and forth to kindergarten, first grade and second grade. And I walked alone. And, you know, anybody who's been bullied knows that's when you get bullied, is when you're alone, right? I walked alone, and kids would just run past me, screaming these terrible things at me. And I would often walk back and forth to school crying. But there was this man, this older man one day who like came up to me and said, "Hi, you know, I have something for you. Why don't you come into my backyard?" And, you know, I think a lot of us now would be like, "Oh, you shouldn't go into a stranger's backyard." And right. Again, that was something that was different then too. I didn't think twice, you know, I was like, okay. But this guy was a lovely man. And he brought me into his backyard, which was this exuberant rose garden. And he made me this beautiful bouquet of roses, and he wrapped like tin foil around it so it wouldn't hurt my hands. And he, you know, said, "Here you go. This is for you," and sent me on my way. And this man did this many more times. I would frequently be coming home with roses from his garden.
Aww.
And at the time, I just never thought a thing of it other than, oh, like, what a nice man. And it was maybe 10 years ago that I remembered him. And I put it together. I remember just sitting down and just burst into tears. Like, I realized this man had been watching me.
Yeah.
Going through on these terrible walks, which went back and forth in front of his house. And he probably felt really sorry for me. So he made me these rose bouquets to lift my spirits. And, you know, what a kind thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that story.
Yeah, such a great story. And, you know, gives you a little glimmer of hope that there's.
Yeah. Good.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So in the book, you state that the fire was not the worst thing that ever happened to you. Please tell us about your brother, his role in your life, and what happened to him.
So my brother, Mark, was 5 years older than me. He was my favorite person growing up. I, you know, beyond a doubt, he was the best parent I ever had. You know, my father was also a pretty narcissistic guy, and God knows my mother was. My brother was wise beyond his years, very loving and present, and took really good care of me as best he could, being a child himself. But he suffered from depression, and he also, just like me, was a neglected child and didn't really get any help with any of his problems. And when he was 19, he took his life. Mm. And it was the loss of my brother that was very much the biggest tragedy of my life.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. And I love the stories of Mark protecting you at times when, you know, there was a neighbor who was kind of mean to you, and or when kids were being mean to you, he was your protector, and he was the one that you could go to.
Yes. Yeah. He was really the only one who stepped in to protect me. So, and he just also, it's hard to describe him. Maybe I do my best, but he was an extraordinary soul. You know, the world is not as good a place it would be if Mark Emile de Geer were in this world. So his death was a great tragedy. And yeah, I mean, you know, I'm burned, I'm disfigured, I've been bullied, all that. But those are things that I've made it through, endured, learned some strengths from, versus the loss of my brother, which just, I really can't tell you anything good about it. Like there's, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Let us come from that at all. Yeah.
I love the story where he helped you with your math, your algebra.
Yes.
That was a lovely story.
So he was a genius. He wasn't kind of a genius. He was a genius. And he was particularly great with math. He got like an 800 on his math SATs and stuff like that. He went to MIT and stuff. But I was never very good at math, despite the fact that the school seemed to think I was. And when we started algebra, I just could not figure it out. And the more the classes went on, the less I understood. And anybody who's ever had math anxiety knows exactly what I mean.
Yeah.
And there was at one point, I just, you know, came home from school and I was just hysterical. Like, I can't get this algebra. I don't understand. I was like freaking out. And he said to me, I'll help you. And he took me upstairs. We opened the math book and he had me read aloud the first sentence of the math book. And I read it aloud. And then he said, stop. You understand that? I'm like, yeah. And we did that. We went sentence by sentence. So he could make sure that I was comprehending every little step they took. And by the end of that little afternoon with him, I understood algebra.
That's amazing.
Well, and there's also a picture of you in the book. I think you're a baby in a high chair, maybe high chair, and he's just looking at you. And the love you can see is you as a baby looking at him and him looking back at you. Oh my gosh, it's so sweet. I absolutely love that. Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing that, because, you know, to say that the fire was not the worst thing that ever happened to you, you knew something had to be very big and impactful. Thank you for sharing your personal stories. You know, for people who haven't read the book, and I want them to read the book, I don't want to give everything away. There's more to the story of suicides that and other lessons that came out of that. So I didn't want to gloss over it, but I'm also trying to be mindful of time because we could talk to you for 3 hours, I'm sure. So we've talked about a little bit about the very complicated relationship with your mother. Could you maybe share with our listeners some of the lessons you learned from this relationship?
Yes. Let me pause to say that sometimes I think, you know, talking about these things can leave the impression that these are quick lessons to learn, or that, you know, if we have a great discussion about it, which we're having, that the listener ought to be able to just walk away and like implement that.
Right.
And so I just want to say that I've done a great amount of emotional healing in my life. I've put a lot of work into this. I've been in therapy a lot. I've worked on myself a great deal. This is decades worth of work. So it is really a challenging thing when you have a parent who is toxic. You know, I know from my work as a psychologist too, that even if a client comes in saying, knowing that their parent is toxic to them, the impulse to hope that it can be better if you just say it this way, or if you just try to do this instead, or if you can only be this kind of person versus that kind of person, that maybe your parent will be able to come through for you. That longing and that impulse is very deep, I think, in all of us. And I also am an extremely forgiving person. So my mom would make all kinds of explanations for why she did this or that, or why she would never do that again, maybe. And my impulse was always to be like, well, great. And it took me many times, a long time, to understand that my mom just couldn't help herself. She was who she was. And she was wired as she was wired through maybe actually no fault of her own. But she was not able to be parental or protective or nurturing. And that I shouldn't ever expect that from her ever. And that coming to that place took me a really long time. I'm glad I got there because it enabled me to take care of myself a little bit better, but it was a long and hard journey.
Yeah, we talked a little bit before the show about mother-daughter relationships and that they can be really, really hard. It's unfortunate that it is as common as it is.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm a mother, you're a mother too. It's hard to be a mother. The other danger, I think, is that mothers who are trying to be a good mother often feel a great deal of pressure to be like a perfect mother. And that is not a possible thing. It's not possible to be a perfect mother. Nor does one need to be in order to raise great kids.
Right.
I'm not talking about, you know, minor issues with my mother. I'm talking about a person who inadvertently and without meaning to endangered her children repeatedly and didn't notice or take any responsibility in any way for any of it. So we're talking a pretty profound level of maternal dysfunction, not, you know, not what I think, you know, most of us castigate ourselves for, oh, I yelled at my kid or, you
know, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Lise, thank you for bringing up the fact that this was a very long healing journey. And I do think a lot of people can relate to that. And I know some listeners in particular who have gone through their own horror stories, where it's not just a difficult relationship, but where it was what you're talking about, where they were just not cared for and often put in danger. And the amount of healing or therapy or whatever it is to go through to get to the point where you can kind of get your brain around that and be okay with it.
Yeah, it is a long journey. And, you know, maybe one of the good things about my having gone through it is that that is something I, upon occasion, have to help a client with. And so, again, you know, I will tell you, it takes people a long time to be able to come to a place where they can be at peace with putting up some boundaries.
Yeah.
Boundaries to protect themselves. And, you know, and I did that, and she still broke my heart when she died. So it's pretty tough. Mm-hmm.
So switching gears just a little, on your blog, you posted a chapter that was cut from the book. The title of the blog post was In a World of Pure Imagination, which I'm assuming is a reference to the song from Willy Wonka, one of my favorite songs.
Yes, me too. I love that song.
You talk about the power of imagination in that blog post. Can you talk a bit more about how it helped you and then how at 14 you knew that it could become a problem?
Yeah, sure. So one of the ways that I survived being in the hospital, you know, for really, I don't know, I had like 40 or 50 or 60 operations. It was something like that. It's been a lot. And that was back in the day that, you know, we didn't have TVs at the bed, let alone iPads or anything like that. It was just kind of left to us to pass the time. And I would listen to music and I would pretend I was in the, you know, the Disney movie or the musical. I love those. And when I would be home, I would a lot of times be pretending with friends or even just pretending on my own. I did a lot of imaginative play. And that was protective, right? It got me out of a reality that was basically nothing but grim and frightening and lonely into a world where I was, you know, a hero or a Broadway star or, you know, all of those things. And I had a very good friend for a few years, my friend Melissa, and she and I really, she was also a very imaginative girl. And we had a very intense imagination thing going on. And at some point, like in middle school, when things got particularly bad for me again, I began to fall into that world very intensely. So I was almost all the time pretending that I was in this other world, including when I was at school, including when I was in conversation with people. I would look like I was there, but in my mind, I was in this pretend world. And at some point, I started to think like, oh, this might not be so healthy.
Right.
But, you know, still, it got me out of a very miserable circumstance. So maybe it wasn't. When my brother died, when he killed himself, I had, you know, those big flashes of intuition that you get sometimes.
Yes.
It came to me as clear as anything ever has. Like, boom, I've got to stop this. If I don't stop this imagined world, I'm not going to stay sane. like, I've got to stop this. I've got to deal with my brother's death in the here and now, or I won't be sane anymore. And so I did. Yeah.
That's an amazing insight to have at that age. I think, you know, many adults don't have that insight.
I was going to say the same thing, to have that awareness. It is really amazing.
Yeah. Well, and who knows where these awarenesses come from, right?
Right.
Right.
I've had that kind of experience quite a few times where some wisdom settles down inside me that I don't think came from me, but there it was. And I've learned to listen to those things, like, really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep. They're so strong and they're so urgent. You sort of can't help but listen, whether you then heed that, but you at least hear it.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, we're closing to the end of our time together. And again, we've talked about such heavy stuff, and I don't want anyone to feel like we're glossing over these big things. There just simply isn't time to go through it in detail, but please, please read the book. There's so much in there. There's so much goodness. And I'd like to end on kind of a high note. Lise, you've said that resilience is a skill that we can develop. What advice could you give our listeners on where to even start with that? What could they do to start building resilience?
So research has shown that like 2/3 of people are capable of resilient recovery. Not as rare as it might seem. And I think people actually silently go through a great deal that they don't necessarily talk about, and probably many of us have had a resilient recovery from things that their loved ones don't even know. So, yeah. And there's a lot of things that help people be resilient. And some of them we've got no control over, and some of them we do. So there's a genetic component to resilience. And obviously we don't have any control over that. And there's an economic component to resilience. You know, people with more money have probably better health insurance and live in safer communities and have access to great therapy and things like that. But there's a mindset of resilience that anybody can work on, either on their own or maybe with help from, you know, a psychologist like me. And I don't want to get into it in depth because we could talk about this for 2 hours too.
Yes, yeah, right.
I developed a mnemonic for this mindset, and it's goals plus M&M. So this stands for, the G is for gratitude. O is for optimism. A is for active coping. L is for love. S is for social skills. And M&M is for meaning making. And all of those are cognitive skills and strengths that people, you know, when I say this to people who are really resilient, they kind of, they look at me and they think and they smile like, oh, yep, that's it. Mm-hmm. And for people who are struggling with it, those point to directions of things that you could work on.
Absolutely. And if I remember, there's a little bit more information about that in your blog, right?
Absolutely. And thank you for mentioning the blog, Deb. On my website, leastagear.com, I write a blog that comes out about every other week. And it's a resilience blog. I will say that the word resilience encapsulates so much, I find I can write about almost anything and say it belongs to my resilience blog.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, there's all kinds of stories and articles in there. I think I've written about 50 or 60 of them by now, and they're free. They're just there for readers, and people do seem to get a great deal from them.
That's great. Yeah. I read several while we were preparing for this interview, and very well written. And it was a way to sort of stay connected, even though I had finished the book. So I was glad it was there.
Right. Right.
That's right. Yeah. People have asked me like, oh, when are you going to write another book? And I'm like, well, first of all, I just read about my whole life, so I'm not going to write about next. I am writing regularly, and if you want to keep up with what I'm thinking about or what I'm trying to offer as ways to help cope with what I know has been an incredibly difficult year for people, this blog is a way to stay connected.
That's great. So we will put the link to the website, which is where the blog is, in with our show notes, as well as I'm assuming the book is available on Amazon.
Yeah. So the book, so it's Flashback Girl, Lessons on Resilience from a Burn Survivor, and you can buy it on Amazon. It's in paperback, ebook, and now there's an audiobook, which is beautiful. It's available on Amazon and also Barnes and Noble. And those links also, if you go to my website, the links are there. And my website, I'm going to spell my name because my name is so odd. LiseDeGuire.com, LiseDeGuire.com.
Great. And we will put that in the show notes so people can just click on it and get there quickly. Everybody definitely check out the book. It is, I just get sort of stuck in it, and in a good way, not in a bad way. It's just so consuming, but again, in a good way. And it was such an important book to me. And I thank you, Lise, for sharing your story.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad that the book spoke to you. I mean, that was my great hope in writing it. And thank you for giving me the chance to talk and to connect with your listeners. I think my husband always says that I should say that the book is, yes, it's about multiple trauma, but it's also inspiring and like a really, you know, bouncy read. Like it pulls you in and pulls you along. It's a page turner. So for anybody who thinks like, oh, that sounds really heavy, like, yes, but also it's entertaining.
Yes. I agree with that.
Well, thank you again, Lise, for spending time with us. We're just honored to have you share your story, and we can't wait to share this with our listeners.
Thank you again for having me. I really appreciate it.
Everybody, thanks so much for listening. As always, you can catch the show on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Amazon Music. If you like what you're hearing, or if you have something you want to share with us, you can get in touch with us on our website, thedivinebreadcrumb.com. Lise, again, thank you so much, and you know, continued success with the book. We will be telling everybody about it. So
thank you so much. Thank you
so much for listening, and we will see you next time.
Bye, everybody.